The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Today is the big January 27th, 2014, and I will be talking about the events of today as they turned out, both in Poland and in New York. Was this a good day for Holocaust industry or not a good day? I would say it was not such a great day. we'll get into that in a few minutes. I want to mention once again contributions from our good friends. And this time I want to mention Brian in Alberta, Canada. And he is a new contributor. Betty in Suffolk, UK. Astra and Julian, who I think are in the U.S. And our faithful Dimitar from Ontario, Canada. So much appreciation to you friends. I have posted more letters, I also want to say, from Leopold Wenger, writing from France in July through December 1942. And this is probably my favorite material that I put on my website, carolynyeager.net. Yet, it's not getting the readership I think it should. I can't make people read it. But it's not that it doesn't get more readership than most any other post, but it doesn't get as much as I think it should, like, you know, hundreds and hundreds by now. I put it up a couple of weeks ago, I think. So I'm a little disappointed in that because it's real history. And sometimes it seems, sadly, that the reality is not as appealing as fiction or unless it's full of blood and gore and lots of action. And I realize to some, Poldy, who's the nickname for Leopold, we used to call him BB, but we've advanced past that childhood name, might be a little dry in the way he writes, and it has tended to be pretty mundane in some ways about, you know, what he writes to his family about. I mean, actually, you know, when you write to your family, you don't say everything, particularly since he's under probably some kind of no talk such conditions, can't talk about everything, and then, you know, they want to know all these little things, and you have to, you know, he's a very good son, and he's faithful in writing to his family and his parents. But there's probably not always that much to say. But I think even so, it tells us a lot about the life and the people. And but however, in this latest one, in these last months of 1942, there's a lot more battle action, dogfights and bombing missions, because he's now flying a fighter bomber. So they both use both guns and so on, plus they carry some bombs, and he's flying from France over across the Channel into certain targets in southern England, and there's a lot that's really exciting, I think. So I do encourage people, if they're not aware of that, or if they haven't looked at it, or if they haven't read it yet, to do so. Of course, I guess that's really up to people, and I don't mean to be trying to tell people what to do. And there's going to be, you know, I will be carrying this on through the year of 1943 and 44 and into 45, although I don't think there's any actual letters in 45, but there's quite a bit of commentary and things, some stuff between, well, that Willy Wenger, his brother, knew about. Either he was talking to him or he was just writing stuff. I'm not sure what it is. But it's, and that will be the end of it. You know, basically. So, I'm going to miss it because I like it very much. And I have good pictures from those years. I didn't have too many pictures for this last one. I had to take stuff off the internet because, you know, there are pictures that he took and that are from that time, and they're Some of them are pretty interesting. Anyway, I want to go on now to tell you that I'm very happy to say that the January27.org website has exceeded what I thought it would be by tonight in my mass mailing of this morning, and it has now surpassed the 2,000 visit mark and stands, last time I looked, at 2,085 for the, and that's in a week's time. Today's been a very busy day for the site, and I'm really happy that to see so many people coming to it, just consistent every time I look. It's just, you know, quite a number of goodly number of visitors. The globe is lighting up and so on. Of course, I would love to report that there was 20,000 visits rather than 2,000. But a Holocaust revisionism is not known to attract a lot of people, actually. And but the last few days have been very good, and I attribute that largely to Andrew Anglin for allowing a post from the January 27 committee on his Daily Stormer site on Saturday. I mean, immediately there was a lot of activity at the January 27 site once that went up. And then he's put up something himself, and he's featured my Saturday radio show now there, where I talked about it sometime today. It was featured. So I think that that is largely responsible, since the Daily Stormer is a heavily trafficked site. And it's great to see what can happen when you get on a site like that. So I'm glad Andrew is a friend of mine. It's nice to know, and I really appreciate the boost he's given. But I do know that others have linked to it at their blogs, and I don't know where all links and little comments have gone, because I can't look everywhere. I only know that Destroy Zionism had a real nice link to it. It was put up a few days ago. And there's another one that I saw, and now I've forgotten exactly the name of it. And there are no doubt others, too. So I just want to thank all those who are promoting that new site. And it's gotten off to a real good start for that reason. And, in fact, I looked up the Alexa Global rank for January 27. I expected it to be in the millions, you know, because it's brand new. And it had showed at 875,813, which I think seems too good. I just can't imagine how it can be even that good at this point in time, but I'm not going to argue. It says it had a U.S. rank of 94,000. And as I said, I only put it online. I was the one who was, you know, who had the access there to switch it online. And it was done last Monday, a week ago today. And it was about 5:36 in the afternoon, Central Time. So it's just about 1 week that it's been available for people to look at. Now, I have to brag a little bit, too, while I'm at it, that the White Network keeps improving. I'm rather surprised, too, at how well it's doing. It's currently at 271,970 global rank. That's really, I don't know when it started, but over the last couple of months anyway, it's looked a lot better. And it was always fairly good, but it was like in 400-something for a while, 400,000. Now it's down to, then it was in the 300s, now it's down to 271. It's been like that for a while now, and it has 16,000 in the UK. It's 16,000 in the UK, which is pretty good. We do have a lot of United Kingdom listeners, and I've always had United Kingdom readers at my website. So, and we have United Kingdom supporters financially too, and they're just, you know, it's really good, really great. They're always number two after the US. And anyway, at the White Network, here, we're not doing anything that I know of to improve our ranking. It's just happening thanks to all of you. And, of course, it couldn't hurt that Paul Hickman has joined our network. which we continue to be very happy about. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to have a show. In fact, I can say it's coming up next Monday. Since this is Monday night, Heretics Hour, next Monday, we're going to have a group show here with Tan Stoffel, Paul, and Hadding, and myself. We're all going to be on there, bumping into each other. and Paul is making a special effort. We had a hard time working this out, but he's willing to get on in the middle of the night for him, and good for him. He's a good sport. So that's coming up next Monday. Finally, I will get on to a different subject than the Holocaust. But this month has been totally devoted to that, and I'm doing my probably last show for a while. That doesn't mean I won't be bringing it up, but on this tonight. Now, so I wanted to, the main question here is, and of course I wasn't able to look at the last minute here at what the news was. I tried to check the news throughout the day, and it's just not much. You can't find anything in regular news. Like if you go to Yahoo News, there's nothing there. I have to Google something in there, and if I don't get the right words, I don't come up with much. If I get the right words, the right word combination in the search, then I kind of hit the jackpot. But then I find that the jackpot is pretty sparse too, and that's been very interesting to me. There's not much interest in this, and it's all from Jews. It's Jewish news, and it's almost only Jews that were there today. Only a few non-Jews, but mostly the whole thing at Auschwitz-Birkenau is made up of Jews, mostly from Israel, and then Jews from elsewhere, and a few non-Jews. So let's get into some of the stories today. This was a story at Yahoo, I think. It said they showed some of the survivors walking around the camp, and they have pictures and so on. But so they have in the story, they just have these people being quoted. Today, one of them says Noah Klieger, who's 87. He's a survivor from Auschwitz, living in Israel now. He says, today, 69 years after we left this hell called Auschwitz, we are here again as proud people, as proud citizens of the new Jewish state that rose out of the ruins of European Jewry. Okay. Well, that's all from him. But then they have Labour Party leader Isaac Herzog, head of the Israeli delegation. So he was the head guy who was leading that delegation. That's Israel too. Israel's Labour Party. He'd be a leader in the Knesset. And he said that Jews, now this is a really interesting comment. He said that Jews must work to create for future generations, quote, a different world, a hopeful future, a world without fear, where a Jew will be safe in any and every place. And I thought that was really something to ponder, because and I don't think this is just a manner of speaking, well, Jews should be safe in any and every place. Only a Jew would say that. How can you, anybody, expect to be safe in any and every place in the world that they go? Because nobody's ever expected that. You can't be safe no matter where you go. There are unsafe places. There are places where you don't really belong, where you wouldn't go. Unless you had a lot of escort and protection or something. So this is something, it seems to me, that only a Jew would say. And I think that it reveals the way they look at things, that it reveals a kind of a Jewish agenda that most Jews are somewhat imbued with, that they, again, this specialness, they should be assured of safety and being taken care of and protected no matter where they go. And to put it that anywhere in the world, in any and every place in the world, a Jew should be safe is pretty. That's really what I think we can see that it's all about. They don't expect other people to be safe, only but themselves. They should be safe, and in order to be safe, every place in the world, they have to be in charge. They have to rule the world. They have to be in control of the world. They have to be in control everywhere to make sure that there's nothing happening there that could hurt a Jew. And that's basically what we're dealing with here. And so the story says, I don't know, this is that the Israeli visitors later marched to the nearby site of Birkenau. They started out in Auschwitz I, and they, you know, walked around. They got tours. They went through the museum part, and, you know, there were a lot of pictures of them. And they're all dressed, all bundled up real warm with their fur hats and so on, and looking rather grim or looking kind of sour or dour. And, you know, because they can't look happy. They have to look like, oh, so such a heavy burden here and so on. And then they go to Birkenau and have their memorial ceremony. And then they were going to recite prayers and light candles. And obviously, quite obviously, Elie Wiesel was not there. And he probably will be there next year, but if he's still able and still around, but he did not show up, which I expected because we quit hearing about him. And then they were due to go, which they've already done now. They went to the city of Krakow, and the Polish parliament and the Knesset parliament, you know, parliamentarians that were there, had a joint session in the Polish parliament, and it was dedicated to remembering the Holocaust. So that, you know, and you got a few stories of some pictures, and you won't hear another thing about it. I didn't see any opinion pieces even. I don't know. Anyway, I found something, you know, I mean, maybe I could miss things. I'm sure I have missed things, but I tried to see anything that was around, and it was very difficult. But Deutsche Welle, the German newspaper, had a story. Later today, I saw it. I think it just appeared. And, you know, it reminded me that Deutsche Welle is a worse newspaper than even Der Spiegel, which is actually a magazine. But they are so, into hating the Third Reich and National Socialism and so on. I'll just go on. So today they said in 1996, I learned something, said in 1996, former German President Roman Herzog proclaimed January 27th, the Day of Remembrance for Victims of National Socialism, in an effort to stress the importance of vigilance toward intolerance and hate. Now, that was before this day of commemoration for January 27th. So that took place in 2005 in the United Nations, that they named this day the day of commemoration for honoring victims of the Holocaust. But in 96, this became a special day in Germany of remembrance for victims of National Socialism. Now, I really dislike that. Now, that really irritates me, irks me, that they have a day like that. But, you know, that's what they do. And then this article said that the leader of Israel's delegation and head of the country's Labor Party, Isaac Herzog, said so many travel to Auschwitz this year to cry, but also to be aware that such horror can take place again. You know, I don't know. Everybody who went there was old. all the survivors and so on. So their awareness is not going to last very much longer. So I don't know how important it is. But I thought Isaac Herzog is clearly Jewish, but this Roland Herzog is clearly German. I looked him up. he's a Bavarian, typical looking Bavarian. I'm sure he's not Jewish. He's a Lutheran, evangelical Lutheran. They have the same name, Herzog. And then it says that the German and Israeli delegations were reportedly scheduled to meet later in the day in Krakow for a roundtable discussion on modern anti-Semitism. And that's what Holocaust remembrance has come down to now. I mean, there's not all that much interest in the actual details of the Holocaust, because they just kind of say these usual things, you know, how many people, like, here it is, the next line I was going to quote from the last one from this article. Over 6 million people, they're still saying it. Over 6 million people perished in concentration camps from forced labor, starvation, disease, or extermination. The majority of the victims were Jews. This is what they say. They have to say it. Of course, they know they don't focus on gas chamber in Germany too much. They're a little bit smarter. They're kind of moving slowly away from that. But they have to come up with other reasons that 6 million people perished. You know, and of these, the only one that's true or accurate is disease. People didn't perish from forced labor. They really didn't. They weren't worked to death. They weren't starved. Nobody was being starved except at the very end. And when you see those people that look like living skeletons, that's not from starvation. That has to be from disease. You know, disease can do that to you, but you'd have to be starving for an awful long time to get into that kind of a bone. And look at all those people who were liberated, who were quite healthy and normal weight. And, they had the same problems that the others did. So they weren't, nobody was starved to death. And nobody was exterminated either. So of those four things, the only one that people would have perished from was disease. Or accidents, old age, general, you know, things like heart attacks or, you know, normal things that people die from. Okay, the latest news that came in around noon today, I think this was though earlier than what I just read to you. Let's see if there's anything new here. Okay, that they say, this is UPI. UPI story, around noon today, well, I don't know what time zone that was, but they say lawmakers from Israel, the United States, and Europe, that's who was there. But they were, so it's mainly lawmakers who go to this thing. And then the survivors that they round up and they pay their way and everything. Because the lawmakers are kind of blackmailed into going, or they get points if they go or whatever, and a lot of them are Jews anyway. That's the only, it's all a political, it's just a, they keep this up for political reasons. They keep these days up for political reasons. And otherwise, that's the only people that go there are politicians and Jews of different stripes, you know, like when they don't have any more survivors, I guess they'll invite the children of survivors, something like that, to go. Anyway, they toured the camp, and there was 58 Knesset members in the delegation from Israel. Say it was the largest delegation ever sent by Israel. You know why I think they decided to go? They wanted to have enough people there. I really do think that probably they organized for those Knesset members to go, so they would have something to say in the news that would be, you know, have some substance to it. That, oh, all these Knesset members, you know, arrived, and there's been stories about them all for a couple of weeks already. Not that many, but that's the only thing they have to point to say. So I think that's why they said, come on, we got to get a big delegation to go, and they got about half of them. So that's all they could get to go. The rest of them didn't want to go, wouldn't go or whatever. So they say, then this Johnny Daniels, who was quoted also in that story that I put on my website yesterday, and the Daily Stormer picked it up today, about the King of Fun named Stuart. What is his last name? Short Rala, Rafa or something. This Johnny Daniels was quoted in that story, and he was the Israeli organizer of this event. He's a PR guy, and they spell his name with an H, and in the other story they spelled it without the H, and I'll bet it is without the H, but they wanted him to look more serious here, I guess. He says, he's trying to make it look good. He says, the presence of half the Israeli parliament in Auschwitz is a powerful symbol for that reason. That's a powerful symbol because the Israeli, there is such a, I think what he means is there is an Israeli parliament. That means they overcame and they won out, and, you know, because there's a Jewish, he says, because there's a Jewish state and a Jewish army. He says, we can say never again, because there's a Jewish state and a Jewish army. That means they've got this army to protect them. And nobody can ever come and, you know, hurt them again like was done before. That's what he says. And the fact that there's an Israeli parliament in Auschwitz is a powerful symbol of this. Now, this is the way these people think. And then they said the only Americans who are in this whole delegation of visitors were Eric Cantor, a Republican representative from Virginia, Daryl Issa, Republican from California, House of Representatives. I didn't check him, but I've heard his name a lot. I'm sure he's Jewish. And Carolyn Maloney, Democrat from New York. She's the one I mentioned her on Saturday. And she's not Jewish, but she seems to be, unless she's, you know, secretly Jewish or something, but she's probably in a pretty Jewish district. Anyway, she goes to all these Jewish things. So those are the only three. The rest were lawmakers from 10 European Union member states, it says. And they only had 24 Holocaust survivors there. That's not very many. And then this defense minister, Israeli deputy defense minister, was there, Danny Dannon, and he told the Jewish Telegraph Agency that the meeting of Israeli lawmakers with their counterparts in Europe is a chance to raise issues which cannot be ignored, that is, the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe, whose latest examples were a pig's head at a synagogue in Rome and attacks on Jews in Kiev. Well, you know, I saw this story that at a synagogue in Rome, packages were delivered, and they contained the head of pig's heads. And, of course, you know, Jews are anti-pork and pig, and so that's a even bigger insult that they send just, you know, the chopped-off head of a pig. That is kind of rude and awful, but, you know, don't they have a sense of humor? This is being, I read the story about it, and it's being treated now as a hate crime. If they ever catch, they don't know who did it yet, but if they manage to find out and catch these people, they're going to be in big trouble, even though all they did was send something in the mail that didn't harm anyone, but it hurt their feelings, and it was rude. And so it's a hate crime in Rome, they said. The Rome head of police or whatever said. So, all right, from this, you know, it's like this event is hard to keep up. It's hard to make it seem important. It's hard to get people to go there. It's hard even for the media to care about it. And it's moving, I think, in the direction, as all of this is moving, that toward fighting anti-Semitism. And what the Jews want is to just kind of use the Holocaust, but that's not, they'll use all kinds of other things too, to say that this anti-Semitism has to be stomped out. It has to be stomped out. And they bring that up all the time. It's everywhere. You look, you know, it's always comes down to anti-Semitism. And even I was reading some things on the protocols today, and I was not surprised, actually, but I was kind of, I noticed that what they complain about when they complain about the protocols is that it's so anti-Semitic, and it's spreading anti-Semitism and hatred of Jews. And this is, it's not just what was done to Jews at one time, and let's not let that happen again, but it's, you know, ongoing anti-Semitism, which the whole agenda is that it has to be ended. They have to stomp it out. And that goes with what I read earlier, that Jews must be safe in any part of the world at any time that they go. You know, they have to be safe everywhere. There can't be any anti-Jewishness. And, you know, it's just not ever going to happen. But unless you have a world police state, and I think that's what they have in mind. I really do, because they can't seem to tolerate living where they just should stay where they're safe and happy and where people don't bother them. And they can't push themselves everywhere. But see, they want to push themselves into everywhere. They want to be a presence and a ruling and controlling presence everywhere. It's like these people, they have no limits. They don't recognize any limits. So this is what all this is about, if you ask me. Now, there was this story in Poland that there's a Polish right, something called the Polish right, and it was campaigning against the Knesset members having a joint session in the Krakow, in the Polish parliament, with the Poles, because they said that was compromising their national sovereignty. They thought that they should not allow those foreigners into their parliament and having a session in there. well, they got voted down on that, but they were protesting it. And that, well, we know it did take place. Let's see if there's anything interesting here. Oh, I thought this was funny in this story. This was from the 29th. No, what am I talking about? 3/29. What date is this? I can't tell what these numbers stand for. Actually, oh, here it is. Top. No, that's a different story. Okay. Anyway, whenever it was recent. They were talking about the Holocaust. This was in New Zealand. Okay. Yeah, okay. All right. They were talking about the ambassadors from Israel, Germany, and Poland that are in New Zealand. You know, the ambassadors from those countries to New Zealand were taking part in a Holocaust ceremony at the Holocaust Memorial in a cemetery in New Zealand. And they talked about the theme of it and who was speaking and so on. I was hard up for news. I found things like this. But it was interesting because it said that at the end of this little story, short, members of the public are invited to attend the ceremony. It hadn't taken place yet. Free transport shuttles sponsored by Wilson Funeral Homes leaves Molesworth Street outside Parliament at 1 p.m. with a pickup stop outside Currie Library and returns after the ceremony. I thought that was really humorous that this free shuttle service was sponsored by a funeral home. because naturally all the people who would be going to a ceremony like this would be old people. Old people who were, could die any time. So this was a good place for the Wilson Funeral Home to invest some advertising dollars. Okay. This was not anything. Another little thing took place somewhere in the United Kingdom. In North London, they had some services. Now, Romania, I found this thing about Romania kind of irritated me yesterday. You know, Romania is like schizophrenic, you know. It's trying to be everything and trying to make everybody like it, you know, and get, make friends wherever. And they're building up this this strong relationship with Israel. They probably want Israel's help. They might want money. They might want trade with Israel or something. You know, Israel is trying to make friends with all these Eastern European nations that are hard up and, you know, want help, and they want to, well, Romania is in the EU now. And, but they're, you know, they're economically distressed. So, Israel comes around and wants to help them out and wants to have a lot of influence. And so they go along with it. But here's Romania having this big thing going on. I read it in, there's a big PDF about it. It's their commemorative events on today, with, you know, for the Holocaust thing. And they're going all out how much they care about Jews and, you know, how they have this declaration. I have this declaration, says, the International Commission on the Holocaust in Romania. They're reaffirming their commitment and so on. And they say, being fully committed to doing our utmost for the prevention of recurring tendencies of racist, anti-Semitic, xenophobic, negative attitudes and behaviors, and to renewing our cooperation on the education, research, and remembrance of the Holocaust in order to build a more secure future for all. This is the Romanian government. At the same time, they hate their Roma people, and they've got the most of them than anybody. Hundreds of thousands of them, many hundreds of thousands of them. And, they're trying to get rid of them. And they help them. They want them to go into Western Europe. You know, they don't, these gypsies don't get hardly any benefits or any help in a place like Romania. They just live in absolute poverty. But if they go to, the wealth, who have these set welfare policies for everybody, well, then they get all these benefits and so on and so forth. At least as long as the time limit that they're allowed to be there before they have to be thrown out if they don't find any work or they can't support themselves. But that takes a while. And, they're not all that good at throwing them out. So anyway, that, you know, they want them to go there. So they're polluting white Europe with all their scum, and at the same time they're playing up to the Israel and saying how they're just so against racist and xenophobic and negative attitudes and so on. I mean, it's so hypocritical. And these countries over there in Eastern Europe and Southeastern Europe and so on are just they're not trustworthy. They're not reliable. They're so corrupt. They have so many problems. You can't even consider them. Well, we couldn't, as being concerned with white Europe, couldn't consider them allies, even though they all have some groups that are, you know, right wing or that are nationalist and they say the right things and so on. But the country as a whole is just, it's just a total mess, and it's a bad influence. It's putting its bad influence on the rest of Europe as it comes into the European Union. So that's my opinion on that. Now, again, Hungary is being attacked by the Jews and their Jewish community because they don't want to go 100% along with all of these things. And there's this article in Ecumenical News, which is interesting in itself. I never came upon ecumenicalnews.com before. And the article is Hungary in firing line over Holocaust past ahead of commemoration. And that's where that picture of Irina Wojcicki came from, although she is Polish and has nothing to do with this story, which is about Hungary. But she's also an Israeli and lives in Israel now, so, you know. But it's interesting that this woman, Irina, I'm not going to use this picture of her in the final post of this program this evening. I got another one. But I thought it was kind of an interesting picture because it turns out she's got this museum of several rooms in her home. It commemorates, you know, the 6 million victims is what they say of the Nazi genocide. It's in her home in the West Bank, and you can see in the picture she's got a wall, you know, two walls covered with little photographs and things, and her exhibit. And it says it contains more than 1,000 documents, photographs, artwork, and other memorabilia that she and her late husband, another survivor, collected from their native Poland and surrounding countries as part of their own private memorial to the World War, to the World War II slayings, period. So, you know, there she's in Israel in a Jewish settlement in the West Bank. And she looks horrible and doesn't look like a very pleasant person. And they've got this whole museum inside their home for, I don't know, only I guess other Jews would be looking at it. So it's okay. But they think it's important. Now she's a survivor and her husband too. Why weren't they murdered if they're part of this death camp stuff? Really, it's just amazing, you know. These questions are asked, but they're never answered. Anyway, this story is that says that Hungary has been embroiled in a standoff with the Jewish community about its role in the Holocaust, and they always use that word Holocaust, and is facing accusations it is trying to whitewash its past in persecuting Jews. So, you know, again, the Jewish community is trying to force Hungary, and they're doing it somewhat in Poland too, force them to admit how bad they were to Jews. They were just as bad as the Nazis. They helped the Nazis to persecute the Jews, their Jews, and round them up and send them to Auschwitz and so on. And Hungary, they say, is trying to pretend like it was a victim of the Nazis. And these accusations came ahead of the United Nations International Day of Commemoration that we're talking about that is today. And the UN Human Rights Chief issued a strong statement about the Nazi genocide. And this UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is named Navi Pillay. She is an Indian, a Tamil Indian from India, although she doesn't live there anymore. And she's a very brown-skinned woman, and she's the UN High Commissioner. She said that if people visited the former concentration camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau, where part of the Holocaust was enacted, they could learn about this terrible epic of history. She's saying if you go there, you're going to learn about all this stuff. It's pure propaganda. Well, See, there's two people speaking here. There's her, the story about her, and then there's this other guy, a Holocaust historian, Randolph Bram. I've read about him before. He supposedly has a reputation as a scholar, but that's, you know, in the world of Holocaustianity, where you, these Holocaust historians are given a lot of credit. And he is returning his Hungarian state honor that the Hungary gave to him. What he calls the government's falsification of Holocaust history, because of this monument that they're putting up. I haven't come to that part yet. Where is that? In Hungary, they've put up a monument in honor of, commemorating the German occupation of Hungary. That's it, you know, see, making out like they were victims. And now the Jews are all up in arms about this because they say they weren't, you know, I think I've kind of covered that, but there is this, this monument that's in the center of it all. And so this Randolph Bram he's like Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel, returned, I don't know if you remember when he returned his honor, his big medal. He got the Great Medal of Honor from Hungary. And, because he calls himself Hungarian, but he's also Romanian. He uses both of those because he was at one time or other, both of them. And he returned it a couple years ago over something. It was never said that he actually sent it back to them. That he just renounced it. The wording was kind of that he renounced it. But I bet he still got it. But he didn't mail it back to them. And this guy too, he says that he is returning it. He hasn't returned it yet. And he wrote this letter that, his action is a protest against attempts to whitewash Hungary's role in the Holocaust. He's 91. He's a Holocaust survivor. And, what he received from Hungary was the Cross of the Order of Merit. But he says with a heavy heart, he has to return it. He's supposed to be an expert on the Holocaust in Hungary. And, he says that he's no longer going to allow the Budapest Holocaust Memorial Center to use his name for one of its research departments. He's angry at them too. He's now an emeritus professor at the city of, he's not. Yeah, well, emeritus. He became a professor at the City University of New York. Now, you know, the City University of New York is so Jewish, so they would hire somebody like him from Hungary, who's a Holocaust survivor and all that stuff, and give him a job there. And now he's retired from there. He wrote, the campaign of history falsification which aims to whitewash the Miklos Horthy era has shocked me. That's what he said. Well, Horthy was the leader of Hungary during World War II, and while Hungary was an ally of the National Socialists or of National Socialist Germany. So now this is just where the Jews want to dictate what all these Eastern European countries can do and say and be, and they have to be 100% in the Jewish and Israeli pocket. And they want to also be able to blame them, any of them who cooperated in any way with Germany and did anything at all to Jews. And this includes, you know, they go Hungary, Romania, Poland. Well, not much in Poland, but now they're finding things to get upset with Poland about. Italy, you know, and further down, some of these, I don't know, those were mostly communists down further south, but you know, they just won't, they want to blame them, and they want to be able to blame as many European people as they can, as being persecutors of Jews who have to apologize, pay back, and behave themselves from now on to try to make up for it, and, you know, all of that stuff. So they've got this, so now, you know, there's something called the Federation of Hungarian Jewish Communities, mm-hmm. naturally, and they're threatening to boycott all the events of this memorial that's going up or has been erected or is going to be erected in downtown Budapest to the 1944 German occupation of Hungary. And who cares if they boycott it? But they think that that's, you know, a threat that they can use. And, well, this guy said that in his, I'm not even going to read that. It's just the usual stuff. So the, and now here, Hungary's ambassador to the United Nations is Csaba Karosi. And he told this news agency that he had apologized twice for the Holocaust on Thursday. The first time he said was at a press conference marking the 70th anniversary of the Jewish and Roma Holocaust, and later at the opening of an exhibition that was organized by, among other organizations, the Tom Lantos Foundation, if you know who he is. He's that former House of Representatives, I guess. He never got out of that, past that, from California, the so-called survivor of the Holocaust, who was in the, played up quite a bit in Eric Hunt's film, The Big Lie, the whatever the full name of that was, video or film. He's a horrible guy. He's dead now. But they have this foundation in his name. And this Hungarian ambassador to the United Nations said, "We owe an apology to the victims because the Hungarian state was guilty for the Holocaust." The Hungarian state was guilty for the Holocaust, he said. "Firstly, because it failed to protect its citizens from destruction. And secondly, because it helped and provided financial resources to the mass murder." Then he says, "Hungarian state institutions at the time shared responsibility for the Holocaust. This apology today by the Hungarian state must become part of national memory and identity." Isn't that sickening? He said, "Nobody has ever expressed the responsibility of the Hungarian state for its role in the Holocaust in this form and on behalf of the Hungarian state." Well, you know, you've got these elected officials and these certain political figures talking like that. And then you've got all these people in the country who are just on the opposite side and saying the opposite kind of things and are protesting all of it. And so it is a form of craziness where actually the people at the top are being kind of coerced into the establishment pronouncements. But I don't, you know, and they're willing to do it. So they're sold out. But you also have people, you know, wanting to do other things, wanting to commemorate things in an opposite way. So United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, she's really a piece of work. She said the seeds of hatred are often sown in times of peace as well as in war. See, now, she's from South Africa. That's where she's from. She's Indian Tamil origin, but from South Africa, lived in, you know, South Africa. grew up there, I guess, and she's talking about hatred in other people thinking differently from you. If these people that think differently from her, that if they're, you know, if they're saying what they think, that's spreading hate, right? So she says that, she says about her visit to the historic and terrible place of Auschwitz. She says on January, no, that's not. She says today, we honor the memory of the millions of people, men, women, and children, brutally murdered 7 decades ago for the simple fact of being Jewish, Roma, Slav, or homosexual, because they had disabilities, or were Jehovah's Witnesses, or political opponents. Now, see, she's just totally, everything she says is false there. Because they weren't murdered for these reasons, and they certainly weren't murdered for having disabilities, and people weren't put into camps for having disabilities. But if she thinks that, she's talking about the euthanasia program. See, they get that all confused there. And then no Jehovah's Witnesses were not ever murdered or harmed. It, you know, they were put into the camps because they refused to serve as soldiers. And so they preferred to go into a camp. And they didn't have a bad time in the camps at all because they were cooperating. And anybody who cooperated didn't have a bad time at all. I mean, the whole camp story is just so false. And she says that if anybody goes there, you know, it's a truly humbling and harrowing experience to feel the chill of evil and immense tragedy that permeates its walls and grounds. See, this kind of talk goes on and on. And as long as people are listening, as long as they're there at these commemoration things, they talk like that. But otherwise, as I said already, very few people were actually there. And they were just the usual Jews and Israelis. Mostly it's becoming an Israeli thing. All right, time for the break. Be back in 5 minutes. Thank you. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And I've, let me check here if you're hearing me. I still haven't talked about Steven Spielberg at the United Nations, and I should do that a little bit. I actually didn't find out too much about that until just now, so I've got this story here from Jerusalem Post, and see, they're always in the covered in the Jewish press, and apparently Spielberg in his speech said we must act on what was learned from the Holocaust. So let's see what he said. He said in his keynote address at the UN, he said mass graves don't have to open up before we act. What mass? There's no mass graves going to open up. Oh, these people are so clever. He says, it is a great accomplishment of our species that the testimonies of survivors can be heard in the high chambers of society. Well, he means the testimonies of survivors are being heard in the United Nations. That's about as high as you can get, I guess, in New York City. They mentioned that he's, of course, the director of the Holocaust-era film Schindler's List. And he said the memory of the Holocaust remained with us today, and the victims of the past genocide had now become teachers to victims of recent genocide. Oh, yeah. He says, this is another quote from Spielberg. He said, genocide is an evil. But the greatest evil is when people who have been spared the horrors commit themselves to despair. We know despair and remembering are a choice, but we need to confront and act on what we learned. And it says here in a little news item, it says that at the UN, Hungary apologized for its role. Maybe that was that guy I was reading about, their ambassador to the UN. Maybe he did that. But it might not even be today. Anyway, back to Spielberg. He says he's talking about Schindler's List, said directing the film and interviewing survivors were part of his approach. Yeah, sure, he's interviewing survivors. To offering a platform for what he said was an often encountered hope of survivors to be heard, believed, and understood. Well, if you read website January27th.org and other websites, and you read what particularly Matonio has written about all these survivor testimonies, and you see that they're all lying. You know, why should they be heard, believed, and understood? You know, this whole business about honoring these survivors when they've all been shown to be liars. And so Spielberg says, it took me years of directing sharks, aliens, and dinosaurs. Oh, man. Yeah. Just a bunch of baloney here. Usual stuff. All right, so then Israel's ambassador to the UN, Rod Prosser, stressed that remembering the Holocaust was not enough to guarantee the future for the Jewish people. See, it's all about, these people can get so focused in. It's amazing how they can think that the whole world will go along with only seeing them. And unfortunately, too much of that has happened. And that's why we even had this thing today, because supposedly these Jewish people are so important. And so he says, the state, this is a quote from this, why does this thing keep shifting? Well, came back, though. He said, ambassador from Israel said, the state of Israel is the only guarantee, keeps jumping around, okay, is the only guarantee that the future and fate of the Jewish people will be held in our own hand. See how that goes with what those other people were saying. You know, we are, now that we have a state and we have an army and we have all this influence, we can control what happens to Jews, and we want every Jew to be safe everywhere in the world, and that's the goal, and that's what has to happen to guarantee the future for the Jewish people. Is there any guarantee, you know, for anybody else? No, because everybody is sacrificed for the future of the Jewish people. We really need to learn from this and see how they do this and why we think we can't do it, why we go along with them. Well, I'm going to get into that a little bit in shortly. Let's see. What did I miss here? This UN ambassador goes on to say, the Holocaust has taught us that remembrance without resolve is meaningless. Awareness must be matched with action. You know, these Jewish websites for things like the Jerusalem Post, they are so horrible. They have stuff, if you move your mouse somewhere, something jumps in front of you and you lose where you are, and they've got this thing blinking here, you know, distracting you, distracting me, and everywhere is full of advertising. Just this little narrow band of text here for the story you're reading, and everything else is just all this crap all over. And this is how they are. They're all like this. And they just want to, they're making all the money they can off these things, and they're tormenting the people who are reading it. And a lot of the people who read it are Jews, I suppose, but since there's only so many Jews, I imagine a lot of non-Jews do. They don't care how much they torment even their own people with their crappy ads, ad-filled sites. You can hardly read this thing. So he says, awareness must be matched with action. This is his professor said this. Almost 70 years after the Holocaust, the world is still plagued with anti-Semitism. There it is. Men and women are still persecuted for what they look like, how they worship, and who they love. Quoting Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, who said, "To remain silent and indifferent is the greatest sin of all." Don't you wish you were there so you could listen to this stuff live? Aren't you sorry you missed it? Recently, now they got Ban Ki-moon talking. I'm not going to quote what he had to say. But that's it. You know, how boring. This is what was going on at the UN. I can get rid of this page. Boy, that was pretty bad. And close this down. So, I wanted to sum up here that how things look from the platform of today's activities and the way it's been covered and so on. And as I already said, I think it looks like the power and the draw of Holocaust, in spite of the movie industry, you know, and the kind of stuff that the books that are written, which is all the show of business, the movies and the books and all the newspaper articles that are written by those who are committed to doing things like this, like in Britain, you know, all those, the Daily Mail weekly has something. They have to have their whole old anti-Nazi article, and the Guardian and the Telegraph are not far behind. They have to do that, and, you know, all this stuff that we keeps appearing, and, of course, a whole lot of stuff that we read about Jews and in the, you know, that promoted by Jews comes out of the Jewish news services, and there's a bunch of them, and, you know, and just like today, everything was basically done, created by the Jews, as I said in that something that I wrote on my website, that B'nai B'rith was largely responsible with helping out with the memorial thing in Poland, at Auschwitz and in Krakow. they got very involved, and the B'nai B'rith Poland was involved. And if they do that, because if they don't, maybe nothing will happen. Just like if that big delegation from Israel had not come, they brought the Holocaust survivors. There were only, 24 of them or something? They must all come from Israel. If they didn't do it, nothing would be happening because nobody else does it. So it's all, what goes on in Poland is good for the Polish tourist industry, I guess. I mean, Poland really supports the Holocaust for a lot of reasons, but like the camp, they love Auschwitz-Birkenau because it brings so many people there, and then they spend money other places and so on. So there's that reason, but they're also committed to it for historical reasons, for their keeping their place in history as being the victims and not any kind of perpetrators. So all this, you know, goes on, but it's not, it's shifting to that, the Holocaust took place because of anti-Semitism, that because of hatred of Jews by the Germans and the Nazis, and then they've got, you know, the other people did too, who they include in there when they can. Because they hated Jews, they created this, they put them in these camps. Not any reason like that there was, that the Jews had gone, that the world was going to war against Germany, and the Jews were on the side of Germany's enemies, and the Jews were a security risk, and the Jews were a problem, and so they had to come up with something to do with them and get them out of the public. And all of that, never do you hear anything like that. So it's always this anti-Semitism and intolerance, racism, and is the reason, and that's why that has to be stamped out. And you must include the other. You must have mixed society, so there's none of this hatred of foreigners and so on. All of this is all together in one big lump. I can't think of anything more to say about it right now, so I won't try to. I've got a lot of stuff here, but I'm going to move right on to talking about the protocols. And I also invite people to call if they want to make a comment about today's events or any of this. You're welcome to do so. I'll try to keep my eye on. Let me check my email real quick and see if let's see if there's anything new here. Hadding, Deutsche Welle. Okay. Hadding's got to say, it's not a newspaper. Oh, it's the German government's foreign broadcast service, like the Voice of America. Really? Well, they put out news articles all the time. And when I was looking for things for National Socialist, that group, that little few people who supposedly murdered those Turks, what's that called? National Socialist Underground. I found more there than I was after a while than I was at Der Spiegel, but that's interesting. Deutsche Welle. Well, that makes sense. Thank you, Hadding. It's the German government putting this stuff out, so we see what the line is of the German government. We've been, as we do the International Jew on Thursday and read from it, the protocols come up every so often, not in a big way anymore, but just as mentioned. And then sometimes Hadding and I have a little commenting about it. And of course I was kind of leaving it alone there for a while, but now I've got something got me stirred up about it again. I think it's this anti-Semitism stuff and what to do about this, this Jewish problem and why, how they have so much success and what should be used about it. So I've kind of titled this little thing here, Protocols as a Weapon Against the Jewish Narrative. Well, I think it could be. I think they could be. I really do. And so there was a, we had a little back and forth on the in the comments, and then Katana wrote in something saying that he thought that what the protocols were saying was legitimate, and so he agreed that it didn't matter if they were labeled fake or forgery, if we don't know who wrote them, if it wasn't Jews who wrote it, that they were still, they still told it, gave, I don't have his thing here, I have my own answer to it, but they still gave important information about Jewish conspiratorial behavior, perhaps, and aims and goals, which actually, I will say, I think Hadding doesn't agree with that they have it in that, that they do that in that way, but I think we have to consider that, and I think we have to go that with along with the idea that they do, if we want to do any kind of, if we want to combat it, or if we want to, if we want to succeed in any way in getting rid of this kind of power that they have. So I was saying that just because they're, even if they are what you call fake, or even if they are what you call a forgery, so what? I mean, does that mean that what's the content of them is no good? I mean, I think that's a way to, it can be a way to destroy, to not allow people, not allow us to use certain information. I'm trying to see here where I started writing my own ideas here. Well, I guess this is all my own ideas, since that, this is not what I wrote there. So it's like they put blinders and controls on whites, stopping, this is the program that they have going, by stopping us from talking about Jews and what Jews are doing. And the International Jew points this out again and again, you know, that Jews want, the Jewish interests want to stop us from talking, stop whites, but also anybody, anywhere, stop people from talking about Jews. But we're the most important enemy that they have, and not notice what they're doing. They want a lot of attention when they're bragging about themselves, when they're praising themselves, or when they think they've done something that should get attention. But the rest of the time, when it's something they don't, that isn't good about them, they don't want it to be talked about. That's a fact. That's known. And as I said, the writers of the International Jew point that out again and again, and Henry Ford did so also. Okay, I'm gonna leave that. I think that maybe we've been waylaid in this regard, about the protocols, because both Henry Ford and Adolf Hitler recognized them as true and highly effective against Jewish power. And I think that's the real, concern, is if they're effective. And of course, there are those who say they're not effective. Hadding and lots of others say they're not effective, but I think, that they can be effective. And you know, they've been put off limits so that nobody none of the more intelligent or intellectuals among us, or the good commentators and so on, or analysts go anywhere near them and analyze them and talk about them and to find out just how they can be used better, you know, how they can be more effective, because they're like discredited. And I don't see why they should be discredited. We allow ourselves to be kept from using this, this weapon, which could be a very good weapon. I think it is a good, it's, everybody who comes upon it is, struck by the power of the ideas. And they're really, they really are. And then they're told, oh, well, this is a fake. This is a forgery. Makes us look stupid to talk about this. So it's, so let's see, if you're, when people are already in power, they tend to become more conservative, right? To, you know, keep things the way they are. And when you're not in power, you have to be revolutionary. You have to be somewhat revolutionary in order to overthrow the, existing power structure. You don't have to overthrow your entire society, maybe, but you've got to overthrow some things to change the whole order of things. So, and it's true that we have to control the gullible and the less intelligent from being tools of the enemy. And so you could think that, well, you know, people who, it's generally said that people who like the protocols and believe the protocols are the more gullible people and the less intelligent people. But that is not actually true. But you do have to guide these people and not, you know, into what you almost have to indoctrinate these kind of people, the gullible and the less intelligent, in order to keep them from going off into things that they don't, you know, that wouldn't be helpful for the society. So that's why I think National Socialism in Germany had experts in every field, and Hitler had established and was looking for these experts before he ever came to power. All through the 20s, you know, he was putting together a team that he thought was good, and he had a team when he took over in 1933, and they were in tune with the National Socialist program. So everybody on his team was on board. You know, they were not just independent intellectuals spouting off however they wished. You know, say, well, I think this might be good or that might be good. Like we have so much of, we have everybody giving their own views and opinions. But here he had a lot of highly qualified, you know, people with doctorates and so on, experts in different things who were on board with the National Socialist program and were educating the public and putting forth the, you know, what the program of, what Hitler's program was. So this is what I say, like, we need to have, we need to know where we're going. Would be good if we could do this. Know where we're going. What is the way to get there? And then everybody get on board with that. But I don't know, we don't have that at all. And this is a good example like this with the protocols, because arguing about whether it's a forgery and who forged it and why they did is very similar to arguing about the various conspiracy theories, say, surrounding 9/11 or Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing that has been talked about recently so much about how, whether these, and I've talked about it, whether it's useful to discuss this stuff and, whether there aren't better things to discuss, rather than paying attention to the meaning of what took place. So let's say I can't make out my own notes here, but so if this, it doesn't pay to discuss whether the protocols are a forgery or who forged it, or does it? Is it better to decide what they're telling us and to figure out how to use them for our own benefit? That's what I think. And, Let's go into, I'm going to go into just a little bit about the objection to them based on the fact that they're supposedly fake. Now, you know, what does fake mean? Because something is not what somebody else says it thinks it is, does that make it fake? For example, supposedly the protocols are fake because they're parallel passages with Maurice Joly's book, Dialogue Between Montesquieu and Machiavelli. And this book was published in 1864. It doesn't, because there are parallel passages, doesn't necessarily prove that the Protocols of Zion are a forgery, but there's no doubt that, but I don't even care. I mean, if some passages were taken from this book to make the protocols, it doesn't necessarily mean that the protocols are not useful and they don't have any meaning and they're not true in what they're saying. So if there was a worldwide conspiracy of international Jewry, then even if it was kept mainly oral, let's see here, for coordination purposes, it would have to be written down at times. This is from Peter Myers. And then some persons would have written accounts of it. Oh, I don't much care about that. These are some of his reasons what could have happened. How that got in here. You see, there was H.G. Wells' book called The Open Conspiracy, which was similar, had ideas similar to this. There was Benjamin Ginsberg's admissions, that Russian Jew. There was the 1946 Baruch Plan you could see a lot of elements of what is what we see talked about in the protocols. And if you look at the protocols in that light, compared against the historical record, it's a question of how much truth is in it. Now, just because it might be, we don't know who wrote it. Just because somebody said in the beginning that, just because it's been generally thought that it was said that it was written, that it's some kind of old record from the Jews. Old Jewish record of old Jewish conspiracy or something. I don't think that needs to, that doesn't necessarily hold water. And I don't think that if we've realized that that's not what it is, that it makes the whole thing useless. I think it wasn't. I think it's a more modern, it was written by somebody or some people, in a more modern times. And that doesn't mean that it's not worth anything. Even if some ideas were taken from the Maurice Joly book, because here you have Maurice Joly, was talking about Napoleon, was against Napoleon. And in the protocols, we're against the power of Napoleon. It was about the idea of having a forceful, authoritative government on the one hand, and then on the other, having a republic with human rights or civil rights and more freedom and so on. And more democratic, although those words weren't used. It was that kind of a thing. And then the protocols are set up in that you have this not two people debating, but one source that is supposedly comes across as this huge, as this authoritative power of which is considered to be Jewish. You have this very authoritative with a strong idea to rule with an iron hand. And then they are putting across the ideas of liberty, equality, fraternity in order to destroy, in order to weaken and destroy society, as they are taking over. And they show in the various sections of the various protocols how they're doing that. And we all recognize as we're reading that, that we have lived through this, that the world has lived through this, and that it's ongoing. So it is a program. Is it accidental? Is it just, it can't be accidental. But when you see how it functions, it can't be accidental. So if we had people who were credible people who were analyzing this book and these protocols and taking, you know, as you do with stuff that you take seriously, and were working on it and writing about it and discussing it, it could be very beneficial. We could gain a lot from it. And I think it's, as I said, like a powerful weapon. But because they've succeeded in with this story about it being fake, as some kind of forgery, that it's therefore useless. Now, here are some things by, okay. At I found this thing I never found before. It. UCSB, University of California at Santa Barbara. And this is Mark Hughes on his website. And that, I think his, I don't know what his first name is. Herbert Mark Hughes, which was the famous Mark Hughes. He's the son of the famous Mark Hughes. I don't know which one is Herbert. Another one, his name's a little different. But he was one of the, you know, those, people from Europe, I can't think of it, who came, you know, and to change, came before World War II and made a big, big impact on changing our academic institutions and changing a lot of our cultural ideas. And they're cultural Marxists, they were called. This is the cultural Marxists. And this Mark Hughes is the son of one of them, and he's a history professor at University of California at Santa Barbara. So he's got this plushy job there, and he's got a website full of all kinds of junk. And one thing on here is about the protocols, and it's part of something about the Holocaust. But I didn't look at any more than this part of it. And the person writing this is probably one of his assistants or something, one of Mark Hughes' assistants. His name is Jose de la Cruz, and it's titled Plagiarism at Its Best, and it's about the protocols. And, well, it says at the top, the content of this page about denial of the Holocaust was created in November 2003 by Jose de la Cruz at USCB in an introductory lecture course on the Nazi Holocaust. So they've got it all tied in with the Holocaust, which I thought was interesting. And he writes, "The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion is a magnet for controversy." Now, this was just in 2003, November, so it's not like it's real old. And he goes on to say, this publication helped to spread the disease of anti-Semitism throughout the world. See, that tells you right there where they're coming from. This Mark Hughes and his associates here on his university website, how they allow him to have a website like that, I don't know. It seems like such a dumb one. But they do, and he's there. So he says that the protocols did was spread the disease of anti-Semitism. Now, who calls anti-Semitism a disease? Well, people like Abe Foxman, you know. And this goes on to say the protocols are a document that purports to represent the ideas of a secret society of Jewish elders and was published by Sergei Nilus in Russia, or Nilus maybe, in Russia in 1905. Well, we know that. That's where it first showed up, by this Russian Nilus in 1905. That was the first publication. Although, you know, I've gone into this before, and there were some earlier versions of it. But this is the kind of a final official one, 1905. There were some, you know, even in late 1800s. This, or maybe it was just 1901, 1903, something like that. And he says, these ideas are the blueprint for conquering the world. That is, that's what the protocols purport to be. Somebody's writing this stuff and telling how they're going to conquer the world. History can show the impact that this document has had on the human race. And here he goes. He says, Adolf Hitler was influenced by the protocols and therefore helps explain why Hitler believed that Jews were planning to conquer the world. So Hitler read this and it convinced him that the Jews wanted to conquer the world. Consequently, Hitler was responsible for the deaths of millions of Jews throughout Europe. Although at first glance, the protocol seemed... Now, let me stop right there, you see. So now they're assuming, they're jumping to... This is not scholarship, but saying that Hitler read the protocols. The protocols are a document that shows that... says that the Jews want to conquer the world, and therefore Hitler believed that, and that's why he killed all those Jews. He killed millions of Jews. Well, of course, he didn't do that. So the whole thing is false. It's based on fable. There's fake and fables. I don't know if you call that, wouldn't call it forgery, but it's fable itself. You know, this is not true scholarship. Anyway, then it says, he goes on to say, although at first glance the protocols seem legitimate and original, it has been proven that they are a mere forgery of a prior document and hold no concrete evidence of an original author. Well, here again, I say, so what? I mean, it's been proven. It hasn't been proven that they're a forgery of this document. It has only been proven that it has taken parts of this prior document. That's the Jolie book called Dialogue in Hell. It doesn't show evidence of an original author. Well, okay, that's true. We have things that exist in the world that we don't know who the author is. What about the Bible? Of course, I don't want to really compare it to the Bible, because the Bible is not very, is not a sure thing anyway, in my mind. So, but you know, so we don't know who the author is. We do know that it showed up under this Sergei Nilus, but he says he didn't write it. He says, somebody gave it to him. I don't remember, or he found it, or he came upon it, or something. Somebody handed it to him. So we don't know who the author is. Well, that doesn't mean that there's nothing of value in it. But they're saying so. They're saying it's a forgery because we don't know who wrote it. Now, that doesn't make sense. He doesn't actually say that. He says it's a forgery because it's based on a prior document, and that there's no evidence of an original author. So then from that, he says, in sum, the protocols of the learned elders of Zion are a false documentation that has no credibility, and its sole purpose is to spread anti-Semitism throughout the world. You see how that's done there. It's one thing to say, some say we, you know, it's based on another document, some of it. It's not totally based on this other document. There's a lot that's different in it, and it has a different purpose because it's not a dialogue between two ways of ruling your country or your people, but it takes it differently that there's one way that's being established through kind of conspiratorial hidden means and by pretending to be the opposite of what it really is. That's kind of the way I would sum it up. But he says here that it has no. First, he says therefore it has no credibility because it's based on a prior document and it has no author. And then he says he jumps from there to. Its purpose is to spread anti-Semitism. Well, that's their opinion, but that you can't say that that's the purpose of it, to spread anti-Semitism at all. It's to spread knowledge and to people who are being manipulated by somebody, and that somebody seems to be international Jewry. These have been going on for a long time. But see, scholars of ours need to work on this. They need to analyze this and write about it and, you know, figure all this out and see what they come up with. That's what I think should be done rather than have it held away from us because somehow it's been discredited and we're stupid if we would ever think that it might be anything valuable in it. But they're the ones. They're the ones who are wanting, just like Abe Foxman, just like all of them, who wanting to say, oh, don't read this because it's anti-Semitic, and that's the only purpose that it has. And you're an anti-Semite if you would even talk about it and so on and so forth. And they had a bunch of, on this page, there was a bunch of pictures, images of the covers of the books of this thing. And they are all, you know, the ones with pictures of the globe and some snake crawling around it, or, you know, all these kinds of things that we're also used to. And I think these things are overused, and we shouldn't get carried away with images like that, because it does then look like you're not serious and you're just being anti-Semitic. Although, you know, I do buy into the fact that there is a overall Jewish, I don't want to use the word conspiracy, but it has to be. I mean, everything is a conspiracy if people are deciding to do something that, you know, hidden from other people. But for Jews to be in control of the whole world, as I pointed out tonight, these instances in this, these things said about the, that when these people are talking about the Holocaust and they always bring up anti-Semitism, they say how Jews have to be free. Jews have to have, all the rights that they want, and they have to be able to go everywhere they want, and they have to be protected, everywhere. And all these things for Jews. And no concern for anybody else. And as I pointed out, you have to be in control everywhere if you're going to make sure that Jews are protected everywhere. So I think they think they're slipping this in here, or maybe they can't help it. It just comes out that when they say that, oh, Jews are being persecuted, have always been persecuted, and we have to stop the persecution. And then it turns into Jews have to be protected in every single way, everywhere, which is kind of crazy. I mean, I don't expect to be protected wherever I go. I think did I go into that? I think that's something to really think about. Do any of us expect that we can go anywhere and we should be safe and protected no matter where we go? I mean, it's always been, there's places you can go and places you should not go. They're not, your people are not there. You know, there are other groups of people, and maybe they don't like you. And they don't have to like you, and you don't have to like them, and you don't want them to come where you are. And this is the way you're not going to change that. And the Jews know that, but they're just talking about that it should happen because it's for them. They're not really working to make that the case for anybody else, even though they might say they are, like for blacks or something. Do they ever, do they really? You know, I don't want to get into that, but, what does this mean? The French Revolution is more evidence of the inconsistency. Oh, okay. Well, they think, then he uses some examples. And he says, the third protocol states, quote, remember the French Revolution, to which we gave the name Great, the Great Revolution. Now, this is from the, this is the protocol big guy speaking. The secrets of its preparation are well known to us, for it was wholly the work of our hands. No, and then the commentary is, no intelligent and sincere Jew would have made this claim, for he would know that at the time of the French Revolution, the handful of Jews in France did not enjoy political rights and had little or no part in the revolution. This is what the critic said about it, that the Jews had no political rights at that time of the French Revolution, and they had little or no part in the revolution. And yet, French Revolution was carried out by Freemasons. They say, he says, the leaders of the French Revolution were Frenchmen, but a lot of those Frenchmen were Jewish. Some of them were, and they were Freemasons. So I have not researched and looked into that. I have never studied much about Freemasonry, but so many people, including the National Socialists, took it seriously and would have agreed with this statement that the French Revolution was carried out with, by Freemasons, I think. And therefore, you know, I'm prone to agree with that. And then he says, this person on the Marcuse website, after saying the leaders of the French Revolution were Frenchmen, he said, consequently, the purpose of this protocol, the third protocol, is to stir up anti-Semitism. See? I mean, I've never seen that used so much in the commentary about the protocols, but they're doing it here. And so if you, the protocol by saying the French Revolution was the work of our hands, meaning the Jews, that is simply to create anti-Semitism against Jews by this old, as Abe Foxman always calls it, a canard, that the Jews want to rule the world, or they do rule the world, or and I think that's true. I think it's true. Now, then he goes to the first protocol. And he says, in addition to the third protocol, the first protocol states, in all corners of the earth, the words liberty, equality, fraternity, brought to our ranks thanks to our blind agents, whose legions who bore our banners with enthusiasm. That some of this stuff doesn't seem to make sense, but I mean it's not written in the best English. Anyway, the commentary is the phrase liberty, equality, fraternity did not originate with Jews. On the other hand, Antoine François Momoro, a Frenchman, originated the phrase. So okay, so they're like saying that if this is mentioned in the protocols that that they're going to their agents are promoting the idea of liberty, equality, and fraternity, and yet it was not Jews who came up with that, that somehow disavows that whole thing, which is not true, because the whole idea is that Jews ruled from the background through their agents, and so the agents were putting out this stuff, even if possibly the Jews dreamed it up and gave it to them. I'm not saying that's the case, but, you know, it's not this. See, their arguments here on this Mark Hughes website are so bad. Although that whole website is bad, but he is a professor of history in the University of California. Now, it goes on to say on this website, in a time of chaos and anarchy, now this must be in, I don't know. In a time of chaos and anarchy, possessions or properties can become difficult to maintain. According to the protocols, this is the commentary, Jews already own the majority of the world's gold and property. Nevertheless, the protocols call for the creation of chaos and confusion in the world. This would allow Jewish leaders to seize power. Chaos would make it difficult for Jews to maintain control of their property and could potentially result in great losses. Therefore, chaos is a step backwards. Not necessarily. See, this is kind of similar to what Hadding says. I can't say what Hadding says, but he says something, there might be some serious differences, or he would disagree with that. But it's that the Jews already have everything they want, so they don't want to stir things up and make it worse. But, you know, my answer is the Jews never have enough. And that's the truth. They say they already own the majority. They say according to the protocols and according to anti-Semites, Jews already own the majority of the world's gold and property. That even if they own the majority of it, they never have enough, and they want more. That's the way they are, and that's the way people who get so much kind of become. Because the fun is in the getting. You know, the fun is not just sitting back and having. The fun is in the getting. And of course, the desire for power. If you don't have all the power, and you're not safe everywhere in the world that you want to go at any time, and then you still got work to do, so you still have to get more. And then they say that that the Jews wouldn't want chaos and confusion because it wouldn't be good for them. But I say that the Jews always made advances during these times of chaos and confusion, didn't they? They make advances during war. They make advances following war. They make advances during their economic crises that they instigate and help bring about their financial collapses and so on. They make advances through all of that. So why wouldn't they want it if they think they've got enough control that they can always, they'll always come out further ahead? Here's where I've got this. I was trying to explain it earlier, but I didn't do a very good job. I'm saying, comparing Jolie's Dialogues in Hell, which is an attack on Napoleon III, and the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which contains the procedure of a Jewish conspiracy of world domination, shows that the latter was paraphrased and plagiarized from Dialogues in Hell. This is what this commentary says. So, if they use some of the arguments for the Jewish conspiracy for world domination that were found in the dialogues which were attacking Napoleon III and discussing the different, you know, ways you could deal with society, why not? Because we don't know who wrote that, but whoever wrote that, if they wrote it, and if it was more than one person, or it was one person, whatever, if they wrote it in the 1800s, and they used some of this material, they are familiar with Dialogues in Hell, they are familiar with some of the, because there's material from other books too, and other writers of the time of the 19th century. And then this book came out, these protocols came out, alright, there's questions about them, but does that mean that what's in them is not useful or cannot be proven to be to be useful and to be, and to show. They're not, they don't have, the protocols don't have to be some kind of prophetic thing that's 100% correct in every aspect and in every word. But people recognize that there's so much truth in them. And everybody who reads them recognizes that. And so did I. And on top of that, what I recall is that they are so powerful when you read it. I mean, the, what I'm saying is it gives you a feeling of menace, you know, of there's something bad going on here. And that's what we need. We need to be woken up to the fact that what's going on is really terrible for us. And just looking at the Holocaust and how bad that is for us, and then this stuff, and this whole thing about anti-Semitism, and as the Jews get more powerful all the time, you know, we really need to be woken up to this. And this idea that you call anti-Semitism a disease keeps being brought up here. So my time is up, ladies and gentlemen. I hope I made some kind of a point here. And that, that you got the point, and we will, just continue on from here. Thank you very much, and I'll see you on another program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.